Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is the Coen brothers. If you're wondering, well, wait, didn't you guys cover them already? Yeah, we did, but at the time, we did not know that they were likely to never do another film together. And we also did not have our special guest with us that we have tonight. So I will now introduce our guests for tonight. I'm joined first by Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
I'm also joined by Perry Seibert. Say hello.
What's the rumpet?
And finally, I am joined again by Joseph McBride. Say hello and introduce
Hi.
Yourself a little, Joe.
Yeah, thank you. Good to see you guys again. Thank you for having me. Well, I have a new book out on the Coen brothers, critical study called The Whole Dern Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers, came out in March from Anthem Press. And I have three other books came out in a short period of time. Some of these, you know, take a long time in development, but they all came to fruition at the same time. Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, which is a critical study from Columbia University Press, came out in October. And in December, I published Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy, which was self-published through my Hightower Press. You can get it through Amazon exclusively. And in January, University Press of Kentucky published a new edition, updated, of my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, which is a kind of a combination memoir and critical study. And I brought it up to date by discussing The Other Side of the Wind's completion. I'm in that film, and I give a, you know, kind of an overview of the film as it finally came together. And then I also write about his early film, Too Much Johnson, which was fortuitously rediscovered a few years ago. And so it kind of bookends his career, although he still has unfinished films that haven't come out. But I think that the Coen brothers are kind of like the sons of Billy Wilder is kind of how I view them, and I've admired them for a long time because of that. They're very acerbic, and they're good social satirists like Billy Wilder, and they also mix genres like he liked to do. He tended to do it more from film to film. He would make one kind of film and then another kind of film, but the Coens mix up the genres within the same film. Although, like Wilder, they mix up comedy and drama, and they caused some controversy by doing that, and we can talk about that. And so did Wilder in his day. But I think they're tremendous screenwriters, and as you say, we hope they'll work together again, but they decided to take a hiatus for a while. One reason, Joel said, was when they started making films with Blood Simple in 1984, which was a low-budget independent film, they didn't plan a career necessarily as a brother team for 40 years. It just happened that way, and I guess anybody wants to try his individual wings. And Ethan has written plays and short stories and poetry, and he's just come out with a new film. It debuted at the Cannes Film Festival this week, called Jerry Lee Lewis, Trouble in Mind. And this film is, I'm not quite sure what it all is because I haven't read any reviews yet, but one article said it was all concert footage. I'm not sure if that's true, but he's a very edgy, provocative character, of course. And Joel did his film, The Tragedy of Macbeth, which came out in the fall, a very good film, with Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, who's Joel's wife, a very stylized black and white film, which I like very much. So it's interesting to see them working separately. And they also have a bunch of unproduced scripts that they might get around to doing sometime. But we'll see what happens with them. They're only in their 60s, and it's a good time for them to experiment.
Yeah. So what I was going to do is I will start off, as we always do, with this question. And I will send this to you, Perry. How did we first come to the Coen brothers?
I'm pretty sure that I saw Raising Arizona on VHS. And then I remember my parents adored it, and I saw it. And then I think I've told this story before on the show. My it was tradition for me and my dad to go down and see a Tigers game every year together. We would give just a thing. And then as I got older, it became like more of an all-day thing. And movies started getting involved. And over the course of my teenage years, the movies got more important. and it turned into an excuse to, like, see a game Friday night and maybe Saturday night to stay over in Detroit where we might be able to see some movies we couldn't see in my small hometown. There was a glorious day in 1990 on that trip in which we went back-to-back-to-back to Jacob's Ladder, Frankenstein Unbound, and Miller's Crossing. And that is the point at which I fell in love with the Coen brothers.
Mm. Oh, no wonder.
Yeah, good trio, and they've just come out with a somewhat revised version of it, a little different on Criterion, too.
I'm excited to know what they cut, because I'm hoping they cut what I've always wanted them to cut from that movie.
That's one of my least favorite Coen movies, but what did you want to have cut from it?
It's that pointless shootout, like against the with the building, with the guys that come out with the white handkerchiefs and they kill them anyway, and there's the giant shootout. It's like there is no reason for that to be there. It always just felt like this pause 2/3 of the way through the movie for no reason.
Yeah,
that
kind of
ruins the movie. It's just I love that movie deeply. So
different favorites. Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, I was going to say my first was definitely Raising Arizona. I remember, you know, seeing it. I still can't to this day remember if we went to the theater and saw it, and I seem to think we did, but I know for a fact that, you know, it got rented, and then it was, of course, on cable ad nauseum in the late 80s and throughout the 90s, and I lost count of the times I've seen that movie. Probably I must have seen it at least 50, 60 times as a kid. And I know that seems excessive, but that's how often it would run, and it was kind of comfort food because by that time I'd seen it so many times that it was just easy background noise. And you know that happens sometimes with movies. I know I was talking to my girlfriend the other day, and I said, well, you know, it's like the old Warner Brothers cartoon. You can turn those on, and it's so familiar. But what about you, Aaron? What's your first Coen?
So I'm pretty sure that when I was in high school, I don't know why my aunt was giving me movies they taped off TV. I don't live anywhere near my aunt. I don't see her. I saw her twice a year. But she gave me a tape. Are you ready for this? It had The Shawshank Redemption, Jerry Maguire, and Fargo on it.
Rock solid.
That is weird because I think I used to have a VHS that had those on it.
Well, she lives in Flint, too, so it probably did. They probably just ran them off on their own for some reason. So, yeah, I watched
– It was Fargo.
So
you got to see the big
one. I'm pretty sure that taped off TV VHS copy of Fargo was my introduction to the Coen brothers. And I know I saw Raising Arizona shortly thereafter and was like, this is the same guy? Are you sure?
Uh-huh. Yeah. they're nothing if not diverse. So what about you, Joe? How did you come to them?
Well, when they started, I was really busy writing my Frank Capra biography, and I wasn't seeing current films much for about 2 or 3 years, and I had left screenwriting behind me, so I was kind of down on the film business. And so I missed their first couple of films. I caught up with them later. So I think it was Barton Fink was my first, and I was very impressed by that. Anybody who's been a screenwriter will identify with that guy. He's kind of like Joe Gillis and Sunset Boulevard, you know. I mean, when I was When I first moved to Hollywood in 1973, I got a job in Variety, which was kind of my film school. But I was trying to be a screenwriter, and I finally sold my first script at 76. But I found an apartment very fast, and it was two blocks away from Joe Gillis's dump of an apartment in Sunset Boulevard, and right down the road from the sleazy hotel that Nathaniel West-based Day of the Locust on, which is a huge influence on Barton Fink, you know. And so them portraying Hollywood as hell, literally, that's the metaphor of the film, really resonated with me. So I liked that a lot. And then I think it was Fargo, though, that really kind of grabbed me. I missed Miller's Crossing when it came out for some reason. But Fargo, I actually had a kind of funny reaction to Fargo, so I can sort of understand some of the Coen brothers' detractors. I thought they were making fun of people from my part of the country, the Midwest, which is often ridiculed and condescended to as flyover country. And they're from Minnesota. I'm from Wisconsin. And they had these funny accents in the film. And I was kind of irritated. But then I went home soon after that to Wisconsin, and all my relatives were saying, oh, did you see Fargo? It was so good. You know, I mean, they had the same accents. And they really liked it that there were people like them on the screen. So I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, they didn't get offended by it. I won't be offended. And that's one thing that people take offense at. And one of the things I do in my book, The Holder and Human Comedy, is answer their detractors and critics who I think have short-sightedly criticized them for some of their actual qualities that, you know, rub people the wrong way. But it's they're very unusual. They're very idiosyncratic and provocative and edgy, and those are all good things. And too many films today are they sand down the rough edges of characters, like in Hollywood, everybody's trying to make the characters likable. And, you know, if you took a Humphrey Bogart character in today, they'd say, does he have to smoke cigarettes? And does he have to be such a cynic? And, you know, why doesn't he commit
to... It's just like the new Batman movie made them not have the Penguin smoke cigars, which is ridiculous.
Jeez. Yeah, I mean, it's terrible. I mean, the worst movie I've ever seen is Pearl Harbor, which is appalling for many reasons, but I realize one of the reasons it seems so unreal is, first of all, the haircuts are all wrong. That happens a lot in period films, but nobody smokes in Pearl Harbor, and back in 1941, almost everybody smoked, and it's absurd when you make a period film and people don't smoke, you know, and somehow that kind of, it makes it seem phony, the whole thing, on top of all the other problems with the film. But the Coen brothers don't worry about things like that. They just like to agitate people and provoke people, and I admire their ballsiness. They kind of resemble Spike Lee in that regard. I like Spike Lee because he's a provocateur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Spike's a great director. So, Aaron, excuse me. You know, I'll ask this question next. What are the major themes of the brothers' work?
I think that what... This is me trying to gain my train of thought. What it comes down to, if you boil all of the everything away... That at the end of the day, what the Coen brothers are looking at is fate versus chance. I think that they like to put stupid people in silly situations because you know that a stupid person isn't going to work their way out of it. They're either going to get out of it through fate or through chance. And that's what they're playing with, right? So I think they tend to lean more fatalistic, but they definitely, I think they definitely, I mean, No Country for Old Men is all about chance, right? Flip of a coin. Just wrong place at the wrong time. I think that that's at the end of the day what we're working with the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good overall wide-angle view of their work. I mean, one of the motifs I noticed watching all their films, I started this project by watching all their films in a concentrated two-week period, and I deliberately watched them out of order because I wanted to study them more thematically than, in a progression. And I noticed that they have spinning wheels or spinning circular objects in a lot of their films, and that's a symbol for fate traditionally, and I think they're fascinated by that, fate, as you say, the terrible twists of fate that people get into, but also they love their central characters. Sometimes people think they're contemptuous of them, but I don't think they are. They call them League of Idiots. That's how they're referred to in one of the films. And I usually don't like stupid characters in films because I find them exasperating, but I find them endearing in the Coen Brothers films because they're idiots in the way that we all are. We all make terrible mistakes. For example, the guy, Josh Brolin, comes upon a a drug bust that's or a drug deal that's gone wrong in No Country for Old Men, and he should have gotten the hell out of there as quickly as possible, but instead his curiosity and greed gets the better of him, and he picks up a suitcase full of money and runs off with it, and that's a terrible mistake, and look at all the grief that happens to him because of that. And that's typical of Coen Brothers' view of the world, as people make a fatal mistake, and it's the tragic flaw that people have, greed or arrogance, but there's a tragic comic sense to their work too that's sardonic about all this, and I don't think they're putting the characters down. I think we feel empathy for these people. Burn After Reading is an underrated Coen film. I love that film. It's about a bunch of idiots who work in a spa in Washington, and they happen to come across the memoirs of a disaffected CIA agent played by John Malkovich, who's kind of a complete screw-up, and they try to sell the memoirs to the Russian embassy. And the Russian embassy can't quite figure out why they're trying to, betray their country, in effect, because also they said the memoirs don't have anything of interest. I think they call them poppycock or gobbledygook, I think is the word. And these people are bunglers, and they do it because Frances McDormand wants plastic surgery in the film, and that's pathetic. But, it causes all kinds of grief. But they mix up violence and comedy, which I think is the number one thing that bothers some of their detractors. But I think, real life is like that. In daily life, comedy and tragedy go hand in hand, back and forth. Sometimes terrible things are funny in a strange way, or funny things become terrible. And life is like that. One reason I like Frank Capra's films is somebody said they give the sense of life being lived, in a roller coaster between ups and downs. A wonderful thing happens and then a terrible thing happens, and you have to be very careful. And the Coen Brothers get into that. And the world today is full of that kind of turmoil, and so I think they're very they captured the zeitgeist, and that troubles people to see a reflection of reality in films. But they have carte blanche pretty much in their filmmaking, which is very unusual in American films today because the studios are so dominant and the budgets are so high, they don't take chances even more than they it's even worse than they used to. But the secret of the Coen Brothers, partly they've had Final Cut since the early days. They make money with their films. It's not a lot, usually, although two of their films have been very big. True Grit, which I don't think is one of their best, did very well. And Burn After Reading did very well because of Brad Pitt. But they get most of their funding from abroad, where they're more acclaimed, as often happens with American films. Foreign viewers in Europe and elsewhere understand them better, and they're also very harshly critical of American life, and that sometimes doesn't go over well with Americans.
Well, I guess you answered that part for yourself, Joe. So now we'll go to Perry on that question. So what about the what are the major things for you?
I will sign up on all that, but I will add, for me, looking at each of the films, what I can't get away from with them is it's almost this, as artists, they are Bergman-esque in their belief that there is no God. Like, there's nothing to answer to, finally. And so what I adore about them, maybe the most from a thematic standpoint, is that their films work along this continuum where they either figure out a way to work through that in your life, or they simply despair at this fact. And they can play in that entire continuum. They hit so many notes along that keyboard across all of these films, and that's why I find them utterly stunning and true artists. It's just, it is beautiful what they do with that limitation they set for themselves. And yes, it is, I think this answers, you know, so many of the critics who complain that they are making fun of those characters. Sometimes they are making fun of those characters. There's nobody in Burn After Reading you are supposed to sympathize with.
I mean, they say that.
And the grand joke is that Frances McDormand's character, who is the worst character in the movie, gets what she wants at the end. It is the coldest of all their films, and one of the funniest and one of the best. I agree. But at the same time, they can give us something like True Grit or Miller's Crossing, where it says, okay, in the classic sort of, you know, detective way, there is this way you are supposed to go through life. And it's not going to be perfect, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be great, but this is one way to do it, and that's really great that they can play all of those notes. They are not cynics as people, I don't believe, at all. But I think they are very clear-eyed about how hard it is to live.
I think you're right, they're not cynics, and that's part of the continuum I find with Billy Wilder. One of the reasons I wrote my Wilder book was there's a myth out there that he's a cynic and he hates his characters and he's a misogynist, and I think those are both wrong. And I once said to Wilder, and I quote this in the Coen's book, I once referred to his films as cynical, and he said, but if I'm cynical, what adjective do you have for Peckinpah pictures? Which I thought was a great comment. And I said, well, no, I didn't mean to stigmatize you with that. I think cynical is just another word for realistic, right? And he said, yeah, every play by Ibsen was cynical, right? Every play by Strindberg was cynical. And so the Coen brothers, I think a Wilder is a disappointed romantic, is what I.L. Diamond, his writing partner, called him. And I think the Coen brothers I would call disappointed idealists. I don't think they're ever romantic. Maybe, you know, even in their childhood, we don't know a lot about their childhood, but I think they have some idealism in their films. Their characters search for some kind of transcendent meaning in life, and as you say, they don't seem to believe in a god, or at least a benevolent god. Maybe it's a malevolent god at the end of A Serious Man, which is their film that deals with religion most explicitly. It has a devastating ending where this tornado is coming to kill the children at this school, including the protagonist's son. And the protagonist has just apparently gotten a death sentence on the telephone. It's as bleak an ending as you can get. I compare that to Bergman's Winter Light, which, by comparison, Winter Light has a bit of hope in it because the character played by Ingrid Tulin, who loves this very despondent priest, she represents humanity, and she's not a believer per se, but she's full of warmth and humanity. There's nobody comparable to that in Serious Men, which is a very dark film indeed. But I think a lot of their characters are searching for some kind of higher point to life, and they try to express it in very inarticulate ways, which is quite amusing. They remind me very much, one of the questions Adam asked me was to reflect on was, who are their influences? And they say, we aren't really influenced by filmmakers that much, which is unusual for today's filmmakers. Usually are cinephiles or, you know, influenced by television. But they're influenced by writers. And the three they mentioned were Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Flannery O'Connor. And I think they're very similar to O'Connor, who I think is a really great writer, and she was a Catholic, but she had an extremely dark view of life. And Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is their most recent film, which I think is a great film, has echoes of that in the last sequence, where the characters are headed toward the afterlife, and they go into a old hotel, and it's kind of unclear what they find in there, we don't know. But it's similar to an O'Connor story called Revelation, which is O'Connor believed in God, but her she wrote her stories for what she considered a godless public, and so she's not proselytizing, but her characters are kind of terrible people who are searching for some meaning in life, and they can't find it, and that's kind of her point, and that's sort of the Coen brothers' point as well, I think.
Well, you know, we'll definitely get into their influences, but, you know, especially being that Ethan, in particular, is a very literate writer, if that makes sense. You know, I have no doubts on that. So my next question actually goes to you, Joe, and it pertains to your book. You know, now your book, The Whole Darn Human Comedy. You know, when you sent me the copy, I was surprised by one thing. I was like, wow, you know, this thing it's thin. I was like, I wasn't disappointed.
Yeah.
I was just surprised. And, you know, I wondered, was it always going to be such a slender volume? Because it's only, what, 93 pages long? So,
yeah,
you know, was that always the plan?
I've always wanted to write a short book, you know, which is kind of funny because I'm known for writing very long biographies of John Ford and Capra and Spielberg, et cetera. And my Billy Wilder book is about 600 pages, and my Lubitsch book is similar size. But I've been carrying around for years V.S. Pritchett's little book on Chekhov, and in his old age, Pritchett wrote this very short, pithy book on Chekhov, and you know, it isn't necessarily length that matters, of course. As there used to be a cigarette commercial, it doesn't matter how you make it as long as you make it long. I forget the commercial line. But anyway, I always wanted to write something short and pithy. And what I did with the Coen brothers was I did a book called Two Cheers for Hollywood in 2017, which is a collection of my shorter pieces. And I wanted to make the book more current by adding some new material, and I wrote three pieces on John Ford, for example, aspects of Ford that I felt were still controversial. And I thought, well, the Coen brothers are really, they're not exactly neglected. I mean, they've won Oscars and they win Cannes Festival Awards and things, but they're misunderstood. And I usually write books about people who are misunderstood or some injustice has been done for whatever reason. And But I figured, you know, I'll do a short monograph for that book. And so I wrote about a 40-page monograph based on, you know, I watched their films for a couple of weeks. And then I wrote a piece that jumps around thematically rather than film by film by film, which I'm sort of tired of doing, frankly. I've done that before. And in my Wilder book, I take a similar approach. When I come to his directing career in Hollywood, I don't go film by film, I go thematically, and that proved to be very liberating and worked very well, I think, and most readers liked it. But that was influenced by what I did with the Coens. And then Two Cheers is sold pretty well, and regularly it's self-published through, I have a fulfillment house that sells books through Amazon, kind of offbeat books of mine. I don't think it ever quite got the attention I wanted it to get, and so I thought I maybe would spin it off into a book of its own, standalone book to get more attention for it and maybe add to it. And when Buster Scruggs came along, which I think is a great film, I thought, well, you know, I'd like to add that to this book. And Anthem Press, which is based in England and New York, contacted me and said, do you have an idea for a book? And we're doing mostly short books. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do this Coen Brothers book for you. And they said, sure. So I wrote a new piece on Buster Scruggs, which was a challenge because it's six stories in one. And again, you know, I kind of went thematically, but I also dealt with each segment in itself. And it took a lot of work to write that, and it was very invigorating to write it. And I made some small changes in the other part of the book, and I added some, you know, a foreword and bibliography and things like that. But it's kind of an updated version of that book. But Buster Scruggs is a perfect film to add to it because, to me, it's a culmination. I'm sure they saw it that way because it sort of encapsulates all their different approaches to filmmaking. And as I mentioned, one of the things that's so good about them is they're very unpredictable, and they go back and forth even within the same film, from stark tragedy to absurd comedy and vice versa. They don't usually make a film that's all one thing or another. Sometimes, occasionally they have. Miller's Crossing is very grimly dramatic, and Hudsucker Proxy is kind of farcical. But their best films, I think, Fargo, New Country for Old Men, a few other films, mix up comedy and drama in a very challenging way. And so Buster Scruggs has the whole range from complete absurdism to tragic comedy to stark tragedy, more conventional storytelling in the Wagon Train episode, which I think is a really great piece of filmmaking, and then a very allegorical final sequence. So it really, I think, was seen by them as a kind of summary of their work. But I found out they'd been working on this for 25 years, and they said they would write these short pieces, and they didn't know what they would do with them. And then at some point it dawned on them that, hey, we could do an anthology film. And then I don't know when they started thinking about going separately, but it's a fortuitous for a critic that they summed up their career in a sense before they went separate for a while. And we'll see, you know, I'll revisit this book in the future when we see where they went. But that's how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. So now I will go back to you, Perry. And we will actually ask that influences question. Who are the brothers' greatest influences for you?
And again, I don't know if they're really the influences, but for me, I think calling the sons of Billy Wilder is a great choice. For me, they are the sons of Roman Polanski and Preston Sturges.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They've mentioned those two filmmakers as great heroes of theirs.
Yeah, I just, and maybe that's, you know, being of the right age, you know, if you were paying attention closely when Barton Fink, you know, swept the Cannes Film Festival that year, which films aren't supposed to do, it's hard not to equate the two. And, you know, they're absolutely, you know, they're name-checking Sturges throughout, you know, by making Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I think that you can pin everything I love about them back to one or both of them, and I like how they balance those two influences.
Yeah, and I think Sturges, I put a picture in the book, a frame enlargement of that wonderful scene at the end of Sullivan's Travels, which is a key film for them, in which the director, who's kind of, he wants to be more like Frank Capra and do more socially conscious films, Joel McRae is wonderful in the role. He's a comedy director, but he wants to do films with a social message. And he goes on the road, and Sturges is kind of making fun of his pretensions. And he winds up in a chain gang, and it's really a grim, horrific change of style, like in a Coen film. But they're taken to a black church, a beautiful sequence where they're in this kind of swampy area. And the black minister, who's a very noble, dignified character, shows them a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And these poor guys in the chain gang all break into laughter. And Joel McRae realizes, he says, there's something to be said for making people laugh. That's all some people have in this cockeyed caravan. You know, that's kind of what you could say about the Coen brothers, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Cockeyed caravan. You know, it's kind of like their confederation of idiots or confederation of dunces, as John Kennedy Toole would put it. So I think the Polanski theme is good, because Polanski was very into claustrophobia, you know, and Barton Fink is this guy stuck in this hotel. He goes to Hollywood, and I mean, I thought that claustrophobia was very interesting, because when most people think of Hollywood as, you know, the beach and, you know, big sprawling metropolis, but if the reality is you're kind of stuck in your room if you're a writer. When I was writing screenplays, the first time I sold one to a major studio, I said, hey, great, can I have an office on the lot? You know, I thought it was like the 1930s, and they kind of scoffed at me, and they said, nobody has, no screenwriter has an office on the lot anymore. You got to work in your apartment, you know? So you're stuck in your apartment for months on end, and you don't see people if you're a diligent writer, and this poor guy, you know, hardly has any connections, human connections, and the ones that he has are rather toxic, and then this guy who lives next door to him turns out to be the devil, and he, you know, it's a very lonely existence to be a writer in Hollywood, and they capture that very well. It's just, to be a writer in general is a lonely existence. I'd add Franz Kafka as a big influence on them. That's a rather Kafkaesque film, too.
So what about you, Aaron? What would you call their greatest influences?
I definitely agree with everything that's been said, but I think that the single greatest influence on their work has yet to be named, and that's Stanley Kubrick, who is the one filmmaker they have actually given by name. Barton Fink owes as much to The Shining as it does to anything. Just totally lost my train of thought. But there's...
well, that's a great Kubrick point. They both take place in hotels, and they're hellish. Yeah.
Kubrick is quoted so much in their films, either literally in shot selection or just in techniques. They're kind of standoffish while still being curious like a cat about humanity, philosophy of life. I think that they owe much to the maestro.
I think you're right, and I think visually, as you allude to, Kubrick was a very controlled visually. He was a master of everything cinematic, and the Coen Brothers films are very designed and very stylized. They're very beautifully controlled. They don't seem to leave things to chance, although the actors say one reason they're good actors, directors, is within that framework, they let the actors have a lot of freedom, and that's what actually Hitchcock did. Hitchcock was a very controlling director with, he'd set up a frame and actors had to, move from A to B or whatever. But I watched him shoot, and he was looser than people thought. I was on the set of Family Plot for 3 days, and he would direct like any other director. He would sort of stand there and watch the rehearsal. And I interviewed Joan Darling, who's a really good director, a pioneer woman director in the 70s, and she directed an Amazing Stories episode for Spielberg, and she said, "Steven, could you give me some advice on directing?" And he said, "Well, get a comfortable pair of shoes." And she said, "Okay." Then he said, "Sit down as much as possible." And she said, "Okay." And then he said, "Steven, 30 years from now, when they call me to ask about you, is this all you're gonna, all I'm gonna say? Can't you tell me about how to direct?" And he said, "Okay, don't shoot a lot of scenes of the people driving up in cars and walking up the, driveway and going to the door. Just cut from the car pulling up to the guy going in the door." And she said, "Okay, that's good advice, but how do you know where to put the camera?" And he said, "Watch where you're standing when you watch the rehearsal, and that's where you should put the camera," which I thought was a really profound observation. And that's what I saw Hitchcock doing. And contrary to the myth, Bill Crone, based on an article I did, I saw Hitchcock improvising scenes, and Bill Crone went into Hitchcock's papers and found that he didn't storyboard everything. What he storyboarded were special effects scenes or various effects scenes or action sequences, but the dialogue sequences, story sequences, he did like any other director. He would have an idea what he wanted to do, but let the actors move around and watch them and then kind of adjust it. And I think that's what the Coen brothers do, but they have such a strong visual sense. If you read their screenplays, like Billy Wilder's scripts that he wrote with either Charles Brackett or I.L. Diamond, they're very visually worked out on the page, and they read very well, too. They're entertaining. I tell my screenwriting students, don't put in camera directions too much because it's tedious to read, and the director will be insulted if you tell them how to direct it, but those guys knew they were going to direct their own films, so they put in camera indicators, but they do it in a way that's kind of fun to read and keeps you reading those. The Coen Brothers scripts, almost all of them got published by Faber and Faber, and they're just wonderful to read. Unfortunately, they go out of print like most screenplays do, but you can get used copies. They're delightful to read, but they work it out in the office. The two guys work it out in the office like Wilder did with his collaborators, and then they execute it. They have a storyboard artist named J. Todd Anderson, who they give credit to a lot, and he helps them storyboard certain scenes, and so he has a strong kind of silent influence, and he gets credit, and if you look at the end credits of their films, they give him whimsical credits, funny ways of saying artist or storyboard artist, and he directed a film that they wrote, which turned out to be a real disaster called The Naked Man. Very, very strange film about a chiropractor who moonlights as a wrestler. It was a disaster, but the guy has talent as a visual artist. And but I think that's the Kubrick connection, that Kubrick really had it thought out in his brain, but he did give the actors a lot of freedom, too.
Mm-hmm. So my next question is going to be for you, Aaron, and that will be the flip side of this, and that is, what is the brothers' influence on cinema since they debuted?
Is it too much to say everything? I think that of the filmmakers who've come since New Hollywood, God, the Coen brothers and Steven Soderbergh have probably been the most influential, just in terms of getting a movie made. I think that they they were 5 years ahead of Soderbergh on this revitalization of the American independent. They've made studio films, albeit not many, but True Grit made $252 million at the box office. Now, granted, they were on a huge run at that point, and that was kind of the culminating film of a four-film sequence, most of which made a lot of money and most of which were nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. They were doing very well through starting with No Country for Old Men and going through True Grit, probably the culmination of their career as far as everything clicking across the board goes. People talk about the way that Tarantino has shaped independent filmmaking. And they're right. I mean, there's a lot of people who like to play around with the narrative structure and a lot of postmodernism that is derivative of Tarantino. But again, the Coens beat him to the punch, this time by 8 years. Because really, more than anything, the Coen brothers are postmodernists, right? they really kind of perfected American postmodernism in cinema.
Yeah,
good point.
Yeah,
they have
and,
a lot of influence.
No, I was gonna say,
been
then
a lot
you,
of people.
You go on, Joseph, because you're next. So, yep.
Well, I was going to say, I bet a lot of filmmakers wish they had their creative freedom because, you know, I think that the real action in American films today is independent, low-budget filmmaking. I mean, even Nomadland cost $5 million, which seems like a lot of money to me. But I kind of preach to my students, make a film for as little as possible. Orson Welles advised people that way. He said, the more money you have, the less freedom you have. And that's part of the reason he was independent. And the Coens steer clear of the studio system, and could you imagine them getting notes about, well, you know, make Barton Fink a more likable character, or he's such a dour, gloomy guy. You know, I mean, they would scoff at that, and they do scoff at those kind of things. But they have final cut, I guess, because they did so well with their first couple of small films. And
rid of the whole subplot with the Japanese guy in Fargo, and yep.
Yeah, that's a whole topic. I have a whole chapter on ethnic themes in their films, and that's another point of sensitivity. Obviously, and in today's world, people get all upset about all kinds of ethnic things, even if the filmmakers are... I mean, for example, in a class I showed Frank Capra's Bitter Tea of General Yen, which I think is a profoundly anti-racist film, about a white woman who falls in love with a Chinese general and struggles with her feeling of revulsion and attraction. It's like a Hitchcock film, Attraction, Repulsion. But Some student wrote that I was showing a racist film, and I mean, I realize what happens is in the film some characters express feelings of racism, but you can't make an anti-racist film or attack racism without showing racism, and sometimes people get bent out of shape if you show the past where people were blatantly racist about something and criticize it, but, you know, certain films, you know, today is full of blatant racism in our media and culture, but
yeah.
Back in the day, there were people would use the N-word with more abandon or whatever, and if you do that in a film, people get all upset, even if you're trying to satirize or attack it, which is what the Coen brothers do with their ethnic characters, but they don't hide people's ethnicity, and in that, I think they resemble my favorite director, John Ford. And he always showed people of different ethnic groups, and he had humor connected with it. Sometimes stereotypical characters, but a lot of times, they're very lovable characters, and some are flawed just like anybody else. I mean, in A Serious Man, there's a Korean student who wants the protagonist to change his grade, and he brings his father in, and they try to bribe him, and the professor is indignant and says he won't change the grade. And then the father says, culture clash, you know. They're satirizing that kind of thing in academia where people pull out those kind of things to influence professors or intimidate them. And then he violates his principles by changing the grade because he's trying to get tenure. And so they're dealing with some of these hot-button issues, and it gets people kind of riled up. And one example, Jay Horberman, who's often a good critic, and he writes some very thoughtful books on films that deal with social issues. You know, like he writes about films of the 60s or the 50s or whatever. But he didn't like it in True Grit. There's a scene where a Native American gets hanged, and They throw the noose over the guy's head, and he starts to say something, and he gets interrupted by being hanged. And Horberman was outraged by this. And, I made the point that they were making a strong satirical, bitter point there that the white characters in that film, before they're hanged, get to make a last statement, but the Native American doesn't. And it may have caused some nervous laughter in the theater, but it is a serious point. And
one of the points I love in your book, though, that one right there where you basically take Coberman to task for that. I quite appreciated that.
Yeah, I think he's like the leading Coen detractor, although he's kind of a convenient whipping boy for me because a good rhetorical strategy, and I use this throughout the book, is to quote people who, you know, make critical comments and then try to attack them. And I learned that from my Jesuit education. I went to a Jesuit high school, and they taught us how to defend your faith was the whole idea. Like, in other words, you get somebody to say what they believe, and then you pull it apart. And that's supposed to be your argumentative structure. And it's a very good way to argue with people, because often people say something like, I don't like the film because it's boring. Well, that doesn't say anything, and it gets them off the hook. But what you do then is you say, well, tell me why you think it's boring exactly. And often they can't tell you, but sometimes they'll say, well, the scene with such and such I didn't think was interesting or whatever, and then you tell them why it's interesting. And, you know, I kind of take that method. It's kind of a Socratic method. And Hoberman is a convenient foil because he makes some wildly wrong statements or kind of outrageously biased anti-Coen statements. At one point he said the Coen brothers are stubbornly being themselves. Well, who does he want them to be? Steven Spielberg or George Lucas? I mean, they are the Coen brothers.
John Borman, I guess.
You know, if you don't like a director, that's fine. But, you know, to say we wish he was somebody else is kind of like beside the point, I think, you know. But I use him throughout the book, and other people too. Serious Man got a lot of criticism going because the Coens are Jewish, and they grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in Minneapolis, which they said was unusual. I mean, they have a strong Jewish community there, but they felt like outsiders. And, I always am interested in those kind of themes, which I deal with in my Ford and Capra and Spielberg books, too. And Spielberg felt like that. And so they made A Serious Man, which is a very sharp satire of the Jewish community that they grew up in. And my feeling is, like with Fargo, I mean, if I made a film about Midwestern Irish Catholics, where like I grew up in, I would feel happy to make fun of them, you know. But the Coens make fun of some of the Jewish characters. But it's a very serious film, and the protagonist is a very a guy you love, and he goes to three rabbis for answers to life's questions, and the three rabbis are clueless. It's really the Book of Job turned into a film, and nobody criticizes the Book of Job for being too cynical, as far as I know. It's a great work of literature, and but there are three wise men in there that he goes to for help, and the Coens make them three rabbis who are really useless in trying to help this poor man. He's trying to figure out why God is punishing him with all these terrible calamities, and some people got outraged by that film. Certain critics accused the Coens of being anti-Semitic or self-hating Jews, the usual thing that, you know, Woody Allen gets some of that. And so I go into why, you know, what they're doing, why they're doing that, and it's a complex issue.
Every artist gets to be
issue.
Self-critical.
Yeah, and you know, the Coen brothers, they have a funny commentary on the the DVD or Blu-ray of that film where they chat about it, and they don't usually tell people what their intentions are. They're very sly about that, and I'll say why in a minute. But they say, well, we don't really care if people get offended by us dealing with ethnic characters. We just don't care about those problems. We just deal with people as people. Everybody, you know, everybody's fair game for their criticism. And then one of them says, well, it's not like we'd laugh at anybody, right? And they both have a big chuckle over that, you know. So they're kind of equal opportunity satirists. And I think that's the way it should be, frankly. I think nobody is sacrosanct. We're all human, you know. We're all flawed.
Yeah.
That's what satirists do. Yeah.
So, Perry, and your thoughts on this?
Their influence, right? That's where we were? I would say that it is I can't name one aesthetically. I can't name one from a writing standpoint because I don't think that there's a – you know, yes, we all know a Coen brothers film when we see it, but they're so protean and so able to work in different modes that it's hard to try to be them. There isn't one thing that would nail something down as a Coen brothers work as opposed to a Tarantino-inspired work. And so I think, yeah, I think they are the, you know, one of the ultimate role models you can have for how you are supposed to conduct your career if you want to be a filmmaker and be an artist at the same time. I think Soderbergh's the other great example to bring up. Beautiful work on that, Aaron. I agree entirely. Like that, you know, Richard Linklater, how do you work the way you want to work? Sometimes getting a giant paycheck from a studio to not always. You better not rely on that. You better not need it. But when you get that chance, it pays off. And you use that to keep going with all the little movies you want to make. You know, everybody's chasing Wells and Cassavetes. Those are the role models on how to do it. And they're still doing it. And the Coen brothers have done it.
Well, they definitely are.
Well, you know, two other movies of theirs that are big hits, which I could mention, are No Country for Old Men, which also was highly honored at the Oscars, and Fargo was a big hit. And those are both quite bleak films dealing with you know, serial killing. And they're both about law people, not lawmen, because the woman sheriff and Fargo is a great character played by Frances McDormand, but she's a strong believer in law and order, and she's trying to keep the peace. And just like Tommy Lee Jones, veteran lawman in No Country for Old Men, and the problem with both of them face is that the evil of the modern world is so irrational and psychopathic that it's beyond them to control it, and they're both kind of despondent at the end of the film about how do you deal with these kind of characters. You just can't, you know, the whole the old system of law and order and policing is broken down, and they're very dark films, but the public went for them. I think partly with Fargo, Marge, the policewoman, is probably their most lovable character. I mean, she's just a wonderful performance, a highly regarded performance by McDormand, and everybody can understand her. She's a very kind of regular person, but she's trying to deal with things that are very bizarre. And Ed Tom Bell, the character played by Tommy Lee Jones, is a very easily likable, identifiable character. He's a kind of introspective fellow. He doesn't believe in, you know, violence unless he has to. But he's outmatched, and he admits this, by this serial killer. And so I think those characters are so compelling. That's one reason those two dark films went over well. And it proves that the audience will respond to a serious film if the filmmaking is that good. And, you know, the studios condescend to the audience quite a lot by thinking they're a bunch of idiots, and they cut away things that make characters interesting and complex. And you know, you look, I keep bringing up Bogart, who's kind of the original anti-hero, and people loved Bogart's character. He was a man of many sides and many flaws, and that's what they liked about him. And often he came around, like in Casablanca, and he joined the Allied forces, but he was trying to not stick his neck out for anybody. He was a very human, you know, fallible character. So the Coens deal with that, but a lot of their characters are absurd or terribly venal, but they're recognizably human. That's what makes them good satirists. I think of them as kind of like Jonathan Swift, too, like his famous piece on Irish hunger, proposing that the Irish eat their babies. You know, that was his proposal, a modest proposal, classic piece of satire. It's very dark, and it's very much in the Coens' vein. He's considered one of our greatest satirists. And in literature, that kind of thing is accepted more than filmmaking, I think, because filmmaking is a big commercial enterprise, and it's more public. You know, before the pandemic, at least, people would gather.
And there's also the visual aspect, too, you know? The
visual aspect.
Yeah. They don't dwell on violent you know, blood and gore as much as Tarantino does, although they show a lot of shocking killing and stuff, but they don't kind of dwell on the details of it as much as Tarantino. But it is quite appalling in a film like No Country for Old Men, the guy going around with his cattle-killing device, slaughtering people randomly. And the random nature is one of the guys was mentioning, is the random nature of evil. You know, we just saw that with the killing of people at that supermarket, and that's you know, that's a kind of a Coen Brothers situation. How do you deal with that kind of thing that happened?
Yeah. So, you know, where do we go from here? So, you know, Joe, you touched on a little of this, and one of the questions I wanted to ask about you from your book was, you know, you really give it to some of the Coens' critics for being obtuse and perhaps even a bit xenophobic. The unfair maligning of their work is flippant and or hollow, it's cartoonish or garish. So, how satisfying was it for you, just to elaborate a little bit on what you mentioned a few minutes ago, how satisfying was it for you as a journalist, because, you know, you do have a background as a journalist, to make this defense of the Coens' work?
Well, you know, I've done that before with, for example, I've written two books on John Ford, the first one with my friend Michael Wellington. We wrote those books when Ford was out of fashion, and he was getting a lot of heat from detractors who didn't understand him very well, and so we were trying to correct the record. And Spielberg, when I wrote my biography of him, that's the first full-length serious biography. I mean, there was a short biography that was sort of good, but it was sketchy, but mine was a complete elaborate book, and it's still the only aside from the Tony Crawley book I mentioned, mine is the only one full biography of Spielberg that unauthorized that is favorable to him. You know, people write negative biographies. I wrote that because he was getting attacked from right and left, even though he was beloved by the public, the reviewers were still dumping on him, and I thought that was absurd because he's one of our great filmmakers. And you know, the minute he dies, everybody will say, "Oh, he was so great; he was like Hitchcock." And you know, Spielberg, when he was a kid, told one of his high school classmates who I interviewed, he said, "I consider Hitchcock the master." And he said he was really surprised because he said, "I was reading magazines like the Saturday Review of Literature, and they were making fun of Hitchcock as a shallow entertainer, and here's this kid saying I consider him the master." And so he was way ahead of the critics, you know, who didn't really kind of pick up on Hitchcock's qualities until Truffaut led the way. So to bring up Truffaut, when Shoot the Piano Player came out, it got attacked by Bosley Crowther of the New York Times, who was almost always wrong about everything, for its changes of tone. And he
especially the last 15 years of his career.
And Bonnie and Clyde did him in because of similar changes of tone. It was influenced by Truffaut and the New Wave. But in Schutz the Piano Player, there's a lot of farce, and there's killing, and there's, you know, tragedy and comedy mixed up. It's sort of like a Coen Brothers film. And Truffaut mentioned later that he thought the American public has trouble with changes of tone. They don't really understand that as well as European filmmakers and audiences do. And the Coens are like that. They change tone in the midst of a film, and they'll have a killing. And Fargo starts out as kind of a funny, jolly film with this silly guy making this absurd plot, and then it turns really grim. But the public went for it because they had a central character they could relate to. But some of their films cause great anger because of the changes of tone. But that's one reason I like them. And Wilder did that too with a lot of his films. He would change tone and shift from stark tragedy to comedy and back and forth. And it's a very challenging way to keep people on their toes, I think.
Yeah, and I think we've discussed this before on the show that particularly American audiences tend not to like movies, books, TV shows that mix tones, mix approaches that aren't just one thing. You know, you hear the complaint, well, it wasn't tonally of a piece. It couldn't figure out what it wanted to be. And mm-hmm. I think that's very often not the case. It's not so much a problem with the artist or the art as much as how the audience doesn't know how to receive it.
Yeah, and John Ford gets similar things because he loves mixing up comedy and tragedy. And I wrote a piece defending his sense of humor, which actually is the number one. The two big things that people who don't like Ford attack him for are the comedy in his films, which they consider low comedy interspersed with serious drama, and they don't like that. But Shakespeare did the same thing, and he did it to kind of he'd have the scenes at the court where they were very serious in iambic pentameter, and then he'd have scenes at the tavern where they were making fun of scenes at the court and doing it in prose, and that was part of his thematic structure. And Ford does very similar things, but audiences don't quite understand that. And then the other thing is Ford deals a lot with ethnic humor, and you know, a lot of people today just shy away from ethnic humor because it's considered dangerous. I even read somebody speculating that Ethan got out of filmmaking because of this terrible cancel culture they were in. And I don't think so, though, because he's come out with a documentary on Jerry Lee Lewis, who is a very controversial figure still alive. And I don't know much about this film because it wasn't publicized much. It played at the Cannes Film Festival a couple days ago, and I haven't seen a review of it yet, but it's a documentary, and one article said it was all concert footage. I don't know if that's true or not, but Lewis' personal life had many, many highly controversial aspects, so it seems like Ethan is not afraid of continuing to delve into controversial territory where you deal with an artist who is a terribly flawed human being, to say the least. So, you know, I don't think that comment that somebody made proved to be true, but the Coens were kind of fearless, and they've been quoted as saying, we really don't worry about, you know, whether we offend people or not. We really don't care. One thing I'll mention, another reason I think they're misunderstood is it's happened to Ford too. Ford didn't tell people what he thought truthfully. He often would obfuscate the truth. I had that experience when I interviewed him at the end of his career. He put me on and pretended not to remember certain films, and you know, he wouldn't give a straight answer to a straight question. And the Coen brothers are like that, and it's kind of maddening in a way if you want to be maddened by it. But I think what they do is very clever, and it's Spielberg was told by Kubrick once, who was a friend of his. Kubrick said, never tell the press what your intention is with the film, because that's all they will talk about, you know. They'll interpret the film based on your statements in the press. And Spielberg has adhered to that, except in the case of Munich, where he felt, I think, that it was so important politically to be clear about it. He gave some very clear statements, and he still got attacked for it. But the Coen brothers play that game that Ford did. They put people on, like one interviewer asked the Coens, how they view their career. And Joel said, well, I guess it beats throwing trash for a living, you know, that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing Ford would have said. But it's interesting, there's a book of interviews with them. And you notice
but how
when
do you
they
shoot
go
your
Europe,
films with a camera?
yeah, with a camera. That's the classic Ford line, isn't it? With a camera. But when they go to France, for example, where they're very revered and they get a lot of their funding, they're more open and more, yeah, they're highly intellectual guys, and they're more open about discussing the themes of their film in France than they are in America. And that's, I think they respect the European audience more than they do the American press, at least, you know.
Yeah. So now, Perry, you're up next. So here's your question. The Coens have worked in both drama and comedy, often mixing the two. Do you have a preference for which mode of Coen film you most enjoy? Is it the comedy, the drama, or the ones where they have a really good mix?
So, you asked us to put together our top 10 for this, and I'm looking over the 10 films I picked. And apparently I don't. I don't have a preference. I like it all. Whatever they want to do.
Yeah, right.
They
I was looking for my top 10 list, and my top 10 list got deleted.
Well, that's a good attitude. I mean, let the artists do what they want to do, and then, you know, I mean, you know, that's one reason I admired Ford after a while. I was very frustrated as a young guy that Ford wouldn't talk to me straight, but now I really admire that, because most filmmakers today, they when they make a film, they give 100 interviews and they tell you how to look at their film. And Ford, basically, his attitude was, make up your own mind about the film, you know, view it for yourself. And that's what the Coens do. And, you know, when they mix up genres and stuff, that's up for us to react and sort it out in our own heads. Huh? What are your 10 tops, Adam?
Well, that's good. I'm going to keep that for towards the end of the evening. But I will throw that next question, this same question, next to Aaron. So, Aaron, do you have a preference for the Coens mode, or are you with the rest of us that you don't really have a preference?
No, I think I lean more towards their dramatic work. I also love their comedies. I think they made one movie that I would call bad, and it was a straight comedy. So maybe that's biased for me. But no, I looking at my top 10, it's pretty riddled with their dramas. Though I love their mixed modes. Those are sprinkled through, but very few of their what I would call straight comedies are amongst the top of the top.
Well, you know, since I guess that does it. I was thinking this question might last a little longer, but awesome. So that brings us to the next one, and actually, it'll be your question next, Aaron. Your turn. So we're going to do this. Who is the Coens' most important collaborator?
The easy answer, obviously, is each other, right? And so then the easy joke answer is Roderick James. But to name anybody else, I know this is incredibly obvious, and there are easily a half dozen great answers here, but I can't not go with Roger Deakins. I think there is a very fine line between having the energy and the visual creativity of a cartoon and being cartoonish. And that is the difference between Barry Sonnenfeld and Roger Deakins for me. And I think that we would not be talking about the Coen brothers in the terms we do had they not lucked into having Deakins when they did and had him for as long as they did.
Yeah. Yep. What about you, Joe?
Well, I was sitting there thinking the same thing when I was mulling your questions. Deakins, he hasn't shot a couple of their recent films. He didn't shoot The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. That was Bruno Del Bonnell, who also shot Inside Llewyn Davis and Joel's film, The Tragedy of Macbeth. But Deakins did a lot of their films. He's a really great cameraman, as we all know, and there's a certain style that he brought to their work. But their style varies from film to film, too, you know, according to the tone. Barton Fink looks different. That was not Deakins, but Barton Fink looks different from No Country for Old Men and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. But I'd also mention Frances McDormand, I think, obviously. She has a huge influence on both of the guys, and she's taught them a lot about acting. They're great actors, directors, and, you know, we don't really know. I mean, one thing is there is a biography of the Coens, but since they don't cooperate with biographies and people haven't done the legwork, you know, I've for example, in my Spielberg book, I made it clear it's an unauthorized biography, and he chose not to talk to me because he only talks to authorized people. But I interviewed 327 other people, which was valuable because nobody had really interviewed all those other people. They just kind of used quotes from him. But nobody's done that with the Coens. And you know, when I did Spielberg, I thought it's a real pleasure to do a biography of somebody who's living, because you can get to their childhood friends and their school teachers and babysitters. And I got his father. I got a great interview with his father. And with the Coens, you could do a book like that. I don't do biographies anymore, but nobody's done that kind of in-depth book. But the Gates of Eden, which Ethan wrote, collection of short stories, has a very, very suggestive and provocative story about a kid growing up Jewish in Minnesota and feeling very alienated in Hebrew school. And I think that influenced A Serious Man. But, you know, you don't really... It's hard to draw direct connections between their life and their work, and I think they kind of discourage us from knowing that, and that's okay in a way. I mean, with Ford, I felt the dilemma with Ford was, how did these sensitive, beautiful, poetic works come out of this guy who seemed so gruff and rough and, you know, he said, I pose as an illiterate cowboy, and that kind of fooled people. So I was trying to draw the connections, but it's a complex thing when you're trying to connect the work and the life, because, as you know, one thing we have to keep in mind is, just because an artist is somebody we admire doesn't mean they're a wonderful person, and usually artists are not the greatest people in the world anyway, because that's why they become artists, because they have some problems. I mean, Hemingway said, somebody said, what's the best training for a writer? He said, an unhappy childhood. So problems, you know, it's like the grain of sand in the oyster. That's what produces the work. And you can't expect an artist to be a saint. I mean, that's very naive, but a lot of people do that. And but it is interesting to draw connections in a sensible way. But, you know, the work is what really matters in the long run.
Yeah. And now back to you, Aaron. So what about you? Who for you is their most important collaborator?
Well, I believe that the Coen brothers have a holy trinity. And two of the three have been mentioned, Roger Deakins and Frances McDormand. So I am compelled now to name the third, who is Carter Burwell. He has scored every film of theirs ever. He scored every single one of their films, including the No Country for Old Men, which had next to no music. He gets credit for being the composer. They have worked with three cinematographers now. They are four, because it's not shot burn after reading. They have worked with numerous actors, though Frances McDormand seems to be number one leading actress, you know, as she should be. But only one composer, and so gotta add Carter Burwell to that list.
Mm-hmm.
I'd agree, and I would add the storyboard artist, J. Todd Anderson. I always think it's really important to study the collaborators of artists and filmmakers, because directors work with all kinds of important people, and it doesn't diminish their contribution if they work with great people who bring a lot to their work. And
it's always one of my favorite questions to ask, because I think it's so illuminating.
I was going to say, by the way, I misspoke earlier. Deakins did shoot Barton Fink, of course. That's a really brilliant piece of cinematography. So the visuals that he brings to their work, they obviously have an influence on them. They have a strong visual sense, but they have the sense to work with the best. And he's a very versatile cameraman. But that film is a poetic work of visual stylization. It's really fabulous, you know.
The stuff in the hotel is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, they built that set in a warehouse in L.A., and the scenes where, you know, they're running through the flames and stuff just looks pretty hairy and wild and crazy, but it is a very expressionistic film, which you don't see very often in America. So is The Tragedy of Macbeth. It's a very striking-looking film. Bruno Delbonnel shot that. It's very stylized art direction. It's very influenced by Orson Welles' Macbeth, which was also shot mostly on sound stages and got attacked for doing that, but it holds up very well. It's a very, you know, kind of a blend of theater and film, and Joel did that in his own way, and it's really a good piece of filmmaking.
And I'll just add in for myself, you know, I'm not saying that I think he is more than the others or less than the others, but just to throw another name in, you know, I'll put this caveat here for my answer, because the question, of course, is who's their most important collaborator, and I think Aaron has some really good points that there's really three people that you can choose. But you know, let's not forget that they've worked a whole lot with John Goodman, and I don't think that's by coincidence.
Mm.
John Goodman was great.
Classic. Yeah. Yeah, Goodman and Turturro, I mean, they have this stock company, kind of like mm-hmm. John Ford did, and those people really kind of give you the Coen flavor, don't they? They like those kind of highly sophisticated actors who keep you kind of on the edge of your seat, wondering what they're going to do next.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. So now the next question goes to you, Joe, and it's the last question specifically about your book, and that is, what gave you the idea to do the work as an accusation defense format?
Well, I think because, as I mentioned, you know, my motive for writing books usually is, you know, I quote the 2,000-year-old man, the Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner thing, that he asked him, what method of locomotion did you have in the old days? He said, mainly fear. You know, you see a dinosaur and you run like hell. And that's one reason we do anything creatively. But I think in the case of writing books, I do it out of anger or indignation or a sense of injustice has been done generally, you know, like I felt that Frank Capra had misled people into thinking he was somebody he wasn't, and he had betrayed his ideals by informing on some of his writers and other people, and people didn't know that, and I wanted to correct the record, and he had written a fallacious autobiography. And John Ford, I felt, was underrated both times I wrote books on him, and I wanted to show people what a great artist he was. And Spielberg, I thought, was grievously maligned and underrated by critics, if not by the public. And Lubitsch was kind of ignored or undervalued. And Billy Wilder has a lot of fans and people who love his work, and he got Oscars and stuff. But I think there's a kind of misunderstanding of him, people who put him down because he's acerbic and they think he's too cynical, and it's very similar to the Coen. So that was my main motivation. I wanted to write a book disproving their detractors, because I think it's a way of showing who somebody is if you show what they aren't. You know, in other words, I start off each chapter with an italicized kind of paraphrasing a basic maligning of them by their detractors, you know, that they're contemptuous of their characters, or they're cynics, or they're nihilists or something. And then I go through and I disprove these points. And some of them, you know, I mean, I admit that in certain ways, certain films do fit these descriptions. It's not all black and white, but I've been trying to sharpen the understanding, sharpen the focus beyond some of these buzzwords that people use. And I think one thing Billy Wilder said once, he said, if you're not walking around Hollywood with a big grin on your face like an idiot all the time, people think you're a cynic, you know. And A few years ago, I had a heart attack, and I was brought into, I drove myself to an urgent care center, and this young aide was in there taking my vitals, and she said, "Why don't you smile more? You should smile more." And I said, Jesus, you know, smile? I mean, what? And then this doctor came in 2 minutes later, and she immediately realized I was having a heart attack and called an ambulance. But, I mean, this is kind of typical of our culture. They tell you to, somebody in a hospital tells you to smile when you're having a heart attack. I mean, this is insane. But there's a kind of attitude that we should all be happy and Pollyannish all the time. And it's kind of a, that's what totalitarian countries want to do to people, is make them mindless followers of whatever, be happy no matter what. And I think, unfortunately, American cinema, which used to be so interesting, has declined a lot because we expect people to just show us happy things or characters we love, you know, characters we can just adore, and kind of avoid showing upsetting things, whether it's in the past or the present. And, you know, if you make a film about the wars we had in Iraq and Afghanistan, people didn't go to see them, you know, and people didn't want to hear the bad news. They wanted to see superheroes, which is a kind of a escapist fantasy of omnipotence, which we don't have in our everyday life. But the Coen brothers, in their own way as satirists, deal with the complexities of human nature, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and they don't shy away from any of these things. They have some very good characters in their films, like Marva Munson in The Lady Killers, which is a film which is usually dismissed, but I like it. The great Irma P. Hall is a wonderful actress, and she plays the landlady in there. And she's very innocent. She's very beatific in her religious faith, and she has these, you know, bad guys living in her basement plotting these nefarious schemes, and she winds up vanquishing them all without quite realizing what she's doing because of her goodness. And they love that character, and she's like Marge in Fargo in a sense, and she's a delightful character. And some people attack that film because when she gets the money that these guys have stolen, she tries to turn it into the police, and they don't believe her. So she gives the money to Bob Jones University, and she's a black lady. And Bob Jones University, as people know, has often been said to be a racist institution. So people think they're making fun of her. Well, they are to some extent, but it's really kind of a, they're not belittling her, they're just, it's in her innocence, she doesn't realize that she's giving the money to a racist institution. As society has played a terrible trick on her in a sense, and you know, the innocence can be dangerous. There's a great line in Graham Greene's novel The Quiet American. He said innocence is a form of insanity, and I think of that when I see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Some student pointed out to me that Jimmy Stewart's character, who I always thought was a great, wonderful idealist, is actually almost criminally naive because he doesn't know who runs his state. He doesn't understand how the government works, and he's a U.S. senator, you know. And Alexander McKendrick, who directed the first version of The Lady Killers, said that he thought the innocence of the landlady in that film was very sinister because she winds up killing a lot of the characters because of her innocence. So the Coens deal with these paradoxes of human nature, you know, these things that are, people don't like hard truths, and they want to say, oh, somebody's just great or somebody's just terrible. But the truth is we're all mixtures of everything, you know, and some people are leaning more in one direction than another. And, I mean, obviously the guy in Fargo is completely evil, the serial killer. He's almost like an abstract force of nature. He's hardly, seems like a human being. It's almost like an allegorical character. But the sheriff is a very real character. And it deals with this problem we have in the modern world. How do you deal with terrible evil when it's rampant, when we have trouble understanding where it comes from? And that's one of the dilemmas of human nature. And the Coens don't shy away from that. They deal with it. But they use comedy partly because they find a lot of life absurd, but also they're entertainers, and that's what Billy Wilder did, and that's what Swift did, and good satirists entertain while they give you the hard truths as well.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So, you know, we've come now to the part of the show that usually I push it a little bit more towards the end, but I want to do it now so that we don't have to rush to get through it. And that is what I call housekeeping. And that's where we announce all the stuff that's coming up and on Deviant Legion. And, well, right now there's not a lot scheduled, but tomorrow, Rachel's favorite commentary watch, The Hunt. So that will be on the 21st, which is tomorrow, Saturday evening, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then this show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back on June 3rd. We're not going to be here next week, but we will be back in 2 weeks on June 3rd with an episode on Band of Brothers. We are then going to take one more week off and come back on the 17th of June for a look at the career of a director by the name of Francis Ford Coppola. He, probably someone you've never heard of, you know, did some movies back in the 70s called The Godfather that quickly came and went. You know, just one of those guys, right? I'm really looking forward to that show. As a preview, I will say this. My recent reviewing of his films, revisits, and a couple that I missed along the way has brought him way up in my estimation, and I already thought damn highly of the man. So I'm quite looking forward to that episode. So that's what's coming up on Deviant Legion. Now, the next question will be to you, Aaron, and that is, what is your least favorite Coen Brothers film and why?
Well, I hate to throw it out there as soon as Phil mentioned that everybody hates it, but The Lady Killer.
I just find it silly and frivolous. I don't think that there's enough there to justify it existing. I don't think they ever really found the thread they thought they found, and I think that the whole sweater pulls apart when you pull at the one thing they had, which is Tom Hanks charming the pants off everyone in the movie. It never worked for me. I've seen it two or three times now, and I can watch the whole thing now, but that's about it.
Yeah, I literally can't watch that movie again. There's just for me, it's that or Burn After Reading, which, you know, the thing is, I want to eventually give Burn After Reading a second viewing, but I just haven't been able to bring myself to watch it a second time, because when I watched it in the theater, it was such an unenjoyable experience that I haven't been able to bring myself to try it again. Whereas I have done that with a couple of their other movies, and with one notable exception, they've all gone way up in my estimation. And none of those were exactly bad viewings, but just ones where I was like, well, I like it, but I didn't exactly love it. And now I love those movies. But, so what about you, Joe? What is your least favorite Coen?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I'll just make an observation that sometimes when you see a Coen film, you don't like it for one reason, then you go back and you think, oh, I do like this, or vice versa. I've gone up and down in my taste, and sometimes it depends on what day it is, you know, because you have a kind of a yen for a certain thing. The one that I think I really don't like at all is The Hudsucker Proxy. I find that really tedious and heavy-handed and silly and stupid, and I don't mind silly. I mean, I think, Lady Killers is kind of silly, but I do think the original British version is probably a better film, but there are a lot of elements of the Coen film that I like, especially Irma P. Hall, but The Hudsucker Proxy is a bad imitation of Frank Capra movies. They don't really understand Capra's, what he's all about, and it's just overplayed and very broad in a bad way. Sometimes, a lot of times their acting is broad, but in this one it's just one note. And Jennifer Jason Leigh is my main gripe in that film. I find her almost always almost intolerable to watch because she's so mannered. I kind of liked her in the Tarantino film where she played a character based on the Manson girls because she was so bizarre. But in Hudsucker Proxy, she puts on this rat-a-tat-tat fast accent, very
it
stylized.
Doesn't work for me, that character.
No, no. She's supposed to be imitating, you know, Jean Arthur and Rosalind Russell in the 30s films, but those were great actresses who had distinctive voices. But you can't often understand what she's saying, Jennifer Jason Leigh, but she's so mannered, you know. I felt that way about her Dorothy Parker in that Ellen Parker film. You know, in this film, she's just an irritant. I mean, so I think that's the one that I find that I don't like. It has some funny ideas about the hula hoop and stuff like that. But, Capra's films, for all their humor, were serious films underneath, and that's one of the things that they missed in that film. It was just a one-note farcical film, and, you know, it didn't make sense.
Yeah. So now my next question is going to be, I was going to throw the next part of the question to Perry. So what about you? What do you think?
Okay, you asked for least favorite. That means I have to like it a little bit. So I'm not going to say The Lady Killers, which I don't like. I am going to say, and this is it's partially a stance, and it's this one time for me that they go off the rails, and it's Raising Arizona, which I think is brilliant for an hour, and that last half hour is an endless cartoon of fat guys screaming. It has always annoyed me. It feels like such a letdown after what came before, and that's because I am a Bugs Bunny fan, not a Wile E. Coyote fan. I like dialogue. And so that film has always been like this. Just I hate getting to the last half hour of that movie, and I don't think, however much they tried to reach for this really beautiful poetic ending, it just doesn't make up for that half hour. It doesn't land like I think they want it to land. It is one of those moments where I can't tell if they're making fun or not, and I almost hate that more. Just make fun or don't. It's the film that falls apart for me in a way that is all the more painful because that first hour is so good and so funny and is a cartoon and it's still really funny. So that's usually my set answer.
You know, I'd say I agree when they go into the biker fantasy stuff, it becomes totally ridiculous. And I agree that it goes off the rails. But by the way, I made a little faux pas when I said Mrs. Parker in the Vicious Circle was directed by Alan Parker. I was thinking of Parker. It was Alan Rudolph. Jennifer Jason Leigh has a very odd voice as Dorothy Parker. And some people said that's the way Dorothy Parker actually talked because she was kind of a drunk and she was spoke in a very stylized way, but it doesn't work in Hudsucker anyway.
No. So I will go back to you again, Aaron, and ask a question that we had a little bit of a discussion about when I presented these questions. And what is the Coens' most personal work, at least to your mind?
I'm just going to tell the audience exactly what I told you, which is knee-jerk reaction is obviously A Serious Man. It's based in the mid-60s in suburban Minneapolis in a Jewish community, yada, yada, yada. However, that's just the knee-jerk reaction. When I really sat down and thought about it, I don't know how to answer that. Because I think all of their films are both deeply personal, and yet all of them are held at an arm's length by a shield of irony. I don't think that they ever really let us all the way in a way that we can tell when they're personal and when they're not. So I have a short list that includes A Serious Man, for the above stated reasons. I think Barton Fink and Inside Llewelyn Davis
capture their feelings about what it means to be, you know, a public artist. I think "O Brother, Where Art Thou" is really them playing, as Perry mentioned, with their Sturgis influence. And I can add several more. Like "Fargo" is obviously weirdly personal. Otherwise, it wouldn't be set in Brainerd, Minnesota. Like I said, everything is just very personal, but also just kept at arm's length. Their work lives and their personal lives are separate entities, and they want us to know that.
And you, Joe?
Well, I was thinking when we were having this discussion, excuse me, when I interviewed John Ford, I said, was Three Godfathers a really personal film for you? And he said, what do you mean by personal? You know, I thought, well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I didn't really have a good answer for that. All of Ford's films were personal, just like you just said. You know, that's what happens. Ingmar Bergman said what makes a distinctive director is having a personal vision. And the Coens definitely have a personal vision. It gets sort of complicated because there's two people involved, too, and it's kind of hard to separate them. We don't know enough about their personalities, except that Ethan seems to be more on the literary side and Joel a little more visual. But even that is reductive, you know, because they share writing and directing and producing credits on their films. But a very good point. I was thinking of Inside Llewyn Davis. That's very much about what it's like to be an artist in our culture, and the scene in which he plays his heart out to the heartless guy that runs the nightclub, and the guy says, "I don't see any money in this." So, you know, I imagine they've had that kind of conversation many times in trying to raise money for their films, and it's very painful. Although, as often happens with artists, the character is portrayed as not a really first-rate artist. He's contrasted with Bob Dylan, who appears at the end of the film in Long Shot. He's kind of a second-rate artist. He's partly the author of his own misery. And filmmakers often, maybe out of modesty, they don't portray themselves as geniuses, but Barton Fink is definitely their take on Hollywood, but all their films are personal. And I just want to put in a really good word for the segment, The Gal Who Got Rattled, in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It's just really one of my favorite pieces of filmmaking of theirs. Buster Scruggs, my friend Joe Dante, who's a great director, said he, one reason he liked my book is that he thought that's their masterpiece, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and I think it's just a great film all the way through. But that wagon train segment is really haunting and very moving, and it's kind of like John Ford in a way. You know, it's a classical Western film like Wagon Master, but a very dark ending, and it's inspired by a story by an old Western writer named Stuart Edward White, and the boys, the Coens, back in Minnesota were reading Western fiction by Stuart Edward White, who a number of films were based on his work. He's a forgotten figure. And Jack London, they based the wonderful sequence with Tom Waits as the prospector on Jack London. But the sad ironies and tragic ironies of the wagon train episode and the beautiful tentative romance between her and Bill Heck. Zoe Kazan is just great as the lead character. That film really haunts me. So I just throw in a good word for that. I mean, so when you say personal, I don't know what that means. I guess, first of all, we don't know enough about them as persons.
Exactly.
Because they've been maybe, as you say, maybe they've been deliberately opaque, but maybe it's because nobody's done the real digging and try to make the connections like I did with Ford and Spielberg, you know. And you find out sometimes surprising reasons they did some because it reminded them of some event in their lives or some obsession they had, and the Coens' work is full of recurring motifs and obsessions. I'm sure you could track some of those back to things in their childhood, but sometimes you don't know. I think good filmmakers, all their work is personal to some extent, and they certainly don't make assignments, you know, like some people, the classic auteur theory was intended people who worked in the system and were assigned works, and then they managed to make them personal because of their style. Well, the Coens don't have to work like that. They're unusual in American films today because a lot of good filmmakers don't get that luxury of creating their own projects and seeing them through to the end. They get handed a Marvel story or something and have to do their best with it. But my friend Sam Hamm, who wrote the Batman film that Tim Burton directed, said, well, you know, genre films have always been most of what Hollywood does is genre films, and good filmmakers have always managed to put their personal spin on the genres, and that's what the Coens do with the Western genre in Ballad of Buster Scruggs, but they put six different spins on six different kinds of stories in that film, and each character, when I was a screenwriter, I used to think, who am I in this script? And then I realized at one point, oh, I'm all the characters. You know, they're all part of me to some extent. And that's true of the Coens, too. All these characters who are their gang of idiots are part of them, and they recognize the flaws in some of these characters in themselves, and then the good qualities of other characters, you know, or the ways they would like to be. And, you know, I think they're great artists, and great artists create a world, a Coen world, in which everybody is part of them.
So, Perry, you?
I don't think I could improve on anything that has just been said by either of the other guests.
Thank you.
That covers it pretty exhaustively. Let's save more time to go over the top 10 list.
Well,
we
will have that. But here's the question: where do the brothers fit into the historiography of film? You know, where do we really rank them, Aaron?
Oh God. We've discussed my tiered directors list. Right. I've decided finally to commit to the Greek mythological theme. So you have Bergman, you have the Bergman level, and he's all by himself. And then you have the Titan level. There's 12 Titans, so there's 12 filmmakers on the Titan list. And then there's Mount Olympus. And there were 12 Greek gods. So, again, there's 12 filmmakers. And that's nice because it rounds out my top 25. Joel and Ethan Coen are pretty doggone close to the top of the Mount Olympus tier. So not quite the top 13, but definitely strongly in the top 25.
So what about you, Joe?
Well, that's a hard one. I think maybe, you know, George Stevens Sr. told his son, George Stevens Jr., who has a good autobiography out, the night that Place in the Sun won the Academy Award for Best Picture, they were driving home and the Oscar was sitting between them, and George Jr. was, I think, 17, and he was saying, Dad, you know, it's just what a great picture, et cetera. And his father said, well, let's see how it is in 25 years and see if it stands the test of time. You know, and that phrase, the test of time, wound up being used as kind of the theme of the AFI shows for a long time, and I worked on five of those with George Jr. And so the test of time hasn't occurred yet with the Coen brothers. And, you know, on the other hand, with somebody like Spielberg or the Coen brothers, you know, they're still active, but they've had a great bodies of work. We can look at them, and if they suddenly stop filming, they're certainly among the giants of our time. And it's getting harder to make individual films in the American system, you know, commercial system. It's always been harder, but, I mean, it was easier, ironically, in the studio days, as Orson Welles found out. He said, usually, you know, because the moguls would let you do an unusual film every once in a while, but when the system got broken up, everybody became independent producers, and they were less willing to take chances.
I mean, how look at Ford and when he did Pilgrimage, I mean, that's a very unusual film.
Yeah, that's an amazing film. I think that's his first great film, and but that did well at the box office. But, you know, in those days, they made some pretty challenging films. I'll just give an example. When I was a screenwriter, I had this idea. I went to MGM in 1981 or two, and I said, let's remake Susan and God. There was a George Cukor film with Joan Crawford, which is it's based on a play by Rachel Crothers. It's a comedy drama about a woman, a socialite, who becomes a religious fanatic and drives her friends crazy and meddles in their lives. And I said, let's update it to make it about a fundamentalist Christian who is, interfering with people's lives. And the executive I talked to, vice president of MGM, was totally horrified. Oh, my God, she said, we can't do that. You know, we get the religious fundamentalists coming down on our head. We can't make that film. So they had more freedom.
That wasn't Aubrey at the time, was it?
No, he was gone. He was gone. I forget who was running the studio at the time, but this was the vice president. But, you know, in 1940, it was just another film. It was a pretty good film, and nobody got too bent out of shape about it that I'm aware of. But in 82, it was too controversial to make. I had a lot of projects that they wouldn't make because they said they were political. Like, I wanted to do a film about the Bay of Pigs invasion. Nobody's ever made a film about that. And, I wanted to make it like the Battle of Algiers, and they were horrified by that idea. And I could go through a long list. I had a Fidel Castro biopic. I had a wonderful idea for that. Could you imagine what that was like, pitching that idea in the early days of the Reagan era?
That's one reason I'm over like a Spartan church.
although when Castro died, some producer contacted me and said, hey, you mentioned this Castro thing. Why don't we do it? And I put the business behind me long ago. But they don't take chances much anymore. But the Coen brothers do take chances, and the younger filmmakers have a hard time, trying to sell edgy projects, if they aren't. That's why I think it's good to make this super low-budget films, and that's what the Coens did. They with Blood Simple, they raised money from dentists and doctors in their native Minnesota and made this film their way, and they don't think highly of it, but it was a pretty good film, and it got them... It got released, and it was commercial, and, it launched their career. So you can still do that today, and that's what I think needs to be done, is make films independently. Don't listen to outside people telling you what to do, and just make the kind of film you want to make. And that film is a recognizable Coen work. It's darker. It's less funny than some of their later works. I think they learned later how to mix comedy and drama more. And Raising Arizona, they certainly didn't. That got a lot of attention for them because it was really the sign of the arrival of two very distinctive filmmakers with a strong vision, and people kind of paid attention to that. But I think it's ironically harder to get attention. I asked Tom Luddy, who's the head of the Telluride Film Festival, a few years ago. This is right before the pandemic. I said, how many films are made in the U.S. every year? And he said about 7,000 features, and he said about 400 get theatrical distribution. And today, it's hard to get theatrical distribution for anything, but it costs so much money to distribute a film that the other filmmakers, either the films don't get seen or they play in festivals, which is one way to get attention, or, they used to go straight to video, but that doesn't happen as much anymore. But the trick now, anybody can make a film, but the trick is to find an audience for it. And the audience has gotten very conventional again and taking fewer risks. But when you have great filmmakers like the Coen brothers, they manage to make their difficult product work for the audience, in most cases.
And Perry.
You can't tell the history of American film without including them. I don't know how else to call somebody's career important. They are absolutely, we said it, their contemporaries are Spike Lee. And they are one of the examples of the bright and shining 80s independent American cinema movement.
Who still do it? They keep doing in that spirit. It's like the 70s
Absolutely.
Filmmakers, like Spielberg, Scorsese kept going and did well, but Schrader is still making films. But a lot of them kind of made more conventional films. But the Coens and Spike Lee are still making the very idiosyncratic films and making people like them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we are down to the final part. We are about to go into our top 10. And just to let everybody know, we should be able to go into what I call overtime. That is, if the gods of Blog Talk allow us to go into overtime instead of rapturing us, as Carl likes to say. So we may get kicked off, we may not. But in about 10 minutes, our live portion will end. Then we'll go into about up to an hour. Hopefully it won't take the full hour. Hopefully it won't take more than about 20 minutes or a half hour. But about an hour after we go live, let me rephrase that. If we go the full 3 hours, it will run till 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. About 15 to 30 minutes after that, it should be available. So sometime tonight around 8:30 Pacific, 11:30 Eastern Time, you should be able to tune in and listen to what we will discuss after we're off the air. That is, of course, if we don't get completely kicked in the middle of our conversation. Now, as has become tradition, we are doing this in the old Ebert and Siskel, or Siskel and Ebert style, where we start at 10 and work our way to number 1, and we all get to say 10, then 9, then 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So, Joe, what is your number 10?
Well, I didn't put them in an order of numbers because I find it really impossible. As I said, you know, they vary from day to day, and I don't know. The ones that I feel very fond of, I think I put the Ballad of Buster Scruggs right up there because it's, you know, all the different sides of the cones, and it really haunts me, the whole film. Mm-hmm. I guess Barton Fink, because I identify with it. I'm going from 1 to 10, but, you know, I mean, it's all very arbitrary. Barton Fink, because I identify with that guy. I mean, when I saw it again just recently, I thought, oh, my God, I've had so many of these same experiences, almost literally, that this guy went through. It's eerie. Fargo is a great film. Big Lebowski, we haven't even mentioned. That's such a great film that is a fantastic cult film for good reason. It's just a whole way of life and philosophy of life that is expressed in that film. No Country for Old Men, great film. Serious Man, I think, is a very challenging film of theirs. Very, you know, really sticks with you. Let's see, I'm going through the list. Brother Where Art Thou is a terrific film. The Man Who Wasn't There is a good film. That's a very unusual film set in Santa Rosa, California, where Hitchcock made Shadow of a Doubt, and it's the film noir, black and white. It's about a barber who doesn't talk much, which is humorous. One thing we haven't mentioned much, one of the guys mentioned the Coens are great writers of dialogue. I mean, my God, the dialogue in their films is just delightful and wonderful. It's like Billy Wilder, Roman Candle, incandescent quality in their dialogue. They write better dialogue than anybody since Wilder, and they're just masters of that. But they write lines that are complex, and they do something my friend Sam Hamm, the screenwriter, pointed out that Sturgis did. He had often kind of incongruous characters spouting all kinds of very elaborate literary dialogue, you know, some guy you wouldn't expect it, like a gangster or a garbage man or somebody who would come up with some very elaborate, complex phrases. And that was part of the humor, and the Coens do that too. And Wilder did that to some extent, and that's part of the fun of their films. I also, Burn After Reading, I think, is a terrific film. I think you should go back and look at that one again. I think it really holds up, and it's a terrific satire of the CIA, and has a lot of political content. And the characters are very endearing, such idiots, but they're very endearing. Those are the ones that really stand out for me. Some of the other ones I'm not as fond of, or they have some good things in them and some bad things. I don't love every single Coen Brothers film, obviously, but and I have a fondness for The Lady Killers, partly because everybody likes to dump on it. I'm always kind of champion of a film maudit, as they call it in French, a damned film. You know, I feel protective toward a damned film. I'm just a gigantic fan of Irma P. Hall. You know, anything that gives her a good part, I'm really thrilled about. She has an amazing monologue at the beginning of the film where she goes into a police station and is complaining about her nephew playing hippity-hop music, and she gives this great monologue, and the police like her, but they kind of don't take her seriously, and she goes on, and it's just a tour de force of fabulous dialogue. And then at the end, when she comes back and she tells how, you know, what happened with the crime, they don't listen to her, and that's why the crime is not solved. It's very funny. You there?
No, I'm here. Sorry, I had muted the phone so I wouldn't be, because I had coughed a minute ago and I thought I'd unmuted it. Sorry, folks.
Okay.
No, that's great. No, we didn't drop. I was just going to say, there's quite a few on your list that are on mine, but few that definitely aren't. So we will start now. So we'll start the back and forth now. I think what I'll do is it'll be Perry, then me, then you, Aaron, from we'll do 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 that way. So, Joe, just bear with us while we do this countdown. So, Perry, what is your number 10?
Okay, so first the parameters. Let's lay the groundwork. You ask, I take very seriously however you ask this question when you ask it. And this week you phrased it to me as my top 10. So you didn't say the best, and you didn't say my favorite, which means I have to fuse this in my head. So this list would be entirely different with those other parameters. It would be entirely different with those same parameters tomorrow. Here's where I landed right now. And the first one, yes, this is my only cheat, because my draft of this had 9 films. And I was like, there were like, and that there were 2 films on the list that it killed me that they couldn't be there. So I tied for 10, if you'll forgive me, with The Hudsucker Proxy, which I adore. I think Jennifer Connelly is fantastic in it and screamingly funny in it. And I also think it's a sneaky – I like it, – it's their most obviously metaphysical movie, and I've always sort of appreciated it for that. Call that their damn film that I love. And tied with that is Inside Llewyn Davis, which grows in my estimation every time I go back to it. And I do not remember who said this. If one of you know who wrote this line, I would love to give them credit. It is not mine. But I think the most brilliant way to look at that film is this is it might be their most personal film, because it feels like the film that they made in order to try to figure out what would have happened to them had one of them died.
Oh, that's a great comment.
It really is.
That
I
is
don't
interesting.
Know who wrote it.
No,
it's a
no.
Brilliant piece of criticism.
Well, you know, I have a tie for 10 as well. I'm going to cheat here too, and that is The Hudsucker Proxy and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. So, Aaron.
Well, if you guys are tying, I'm adding my number 11 to my number 10. So, The Man Who Wasn't There, for every single reason Joe already mentioned, I think it might be their single most underrated film. Billy Bob Thornton is fantastic. And number 10, I'm sorry, I still abide, but The Big Lebowski. And I know that's low, and I know I'm going to get White Russians thrown at me. But The Big Lebowski at number 10.
Okay, folks, we have about 90 seconds, so if we die completely, we die completely. But Perry, number 9.
Blood Simple. I mean, you know, there might have been better first films, but, you know, why quibble?
Yeah. And my number 9 is Hail Caesar. So, Aaron?
Whoa. my number 9 is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Again, waiting for the hate mail.
Okay. Perry, number 8.
My 8 is Burn After Reading, which I love because it comes at the end of a 3-film run of, or it comes in the middle of No Country for Old Men and A Serious Man. And it is absolutely the coldest, blackest comedy they ever made. And I think it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, my number 8 is True Grit. Aaron?
Blood Simple. I think it's one of the great director debuts of all time.
Cool. So, Perry, you're number 7.
Hail Caesar. It is them playful. They're never playful. It's actually playful and still sneaky deep. I really love it.
Mm-hmm. And mine, A Serious Man. So, Aaron?
I have also A Serious Man at number 7. And here's the thing, because it is based on Job, I have to think that there's a little hopeful ending for those of us who've actually read the book, that maybe the death sentence isn't such a death sentence. He just had to shed all of the things that were holding him down.
Mm-hmm. And so now we come to number 6. So you're number 6, Perry.
Lebowski.
Cool. And my number 6 is Miller's Crossing. Your number 6, Aaron?
Once again, Adam, Miller's Crossing.
Wow. And now this is one where I said that some of these went up on recent viewing. Big Lebowski used to be down around 10 or 11 for me. Big Lebowski is my number 5. Perry, sorry, I had to.
That's okay.
I jumped there, but yep, go on.
And this is the one that, because you said top 10, this is the one that gets the highest for being what it is, not because I think I love it the most, and that's No Country for Old Men.
Ooh. And
it's great. It's definitely great.
Inside Llewelyn Davis. I think it is the superior of their two Odyssey adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Perry, you're number 4.
Fargo. And I want to talk for a little bit why. Because
okay.
Fargo is arguably their most subversive screenplay. Because if you've read or know, you know, the Sid Field classic three-act Hollywood structure, William H. Macy is the protagonist in that movie. And the reason it works is because they set up this innocent who discovers how dark the world is, and they're the antagonist. And that messes with people in a way I don't think they understand. And I think that's brilliant, and that you get to end it with that note of, you know, there is still, she is concerned, she is worried, but she has her husband, and she's going to have this baby. It is the Coens at
and he's got
one
the
of their darkest
stamp.
And coldest, and still giving us, you can get through this. And that's why it remains one of their best films, and their first most loved film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, Aaron? Let's see.
4?
Yep, 4.
True Grit. I love this film. from Haley Steinfeld, who I think gave a great, I think it was her debut performance.
Yeah.
If it wasn't, it was her first major role. Jeff Bridges, who I really, really thought should have defeated Colin Firth once again for the Oscar that year, to the Carter Burwell reimaginings of the old gospel songs. I adore this movie. It's one that I always think, do I actually love it as much as I do? And I watch it again, and it's like, yeah, I really love this movie.
No, it's a great one. So Yeah, my number four is Oh Brother Where Art Thou. Perry?
My three is Barton Fink, which there's nothing like it. It is, you know, yes, there's Polanski, yes, there's Hammett and Chandler, but boy, that is a nightmare movie if ever there was one, and I mean that in the best possible praise.
Yep. Barton Fink is my number three as well, and this is another one of the ones that went up. It used to be down around eight. It's now number three. So, Aaron?
Make it a hat trick.
Nice!
Barton Fink, there's a slight drop-off for me after the top three. I think that Barton Fink was their first, like, true masterpiece. I love their films, but I think that Barton Fink just took it to another level. And as Perry said, it's a film that's truly unique. And how often do you get to say that about anything anymore? It's fantastic. And if they weren't the Coen brothers, it would be number one. But they are.
So, Perry, you're number two.
A Serious Man. And again, I'm just going to piggyback on the phrase. This the most startling original work that they've produced. It is the only film in their filmography that I truly cannot imagine anybody else making ever. That's why it feels like their most personal. It just feels like the most Coen Brothers film that can be. And it is, all the things we talked about earlier about it, it is just the most, depressing isn't the right word, whatever we need to get to reach the deepest possible despondency. That's where you're left at the end of that. And you were left there not 5 minutes after one of the biggest laughs that they ever constructed, which is that 90-minute wait to pay off the Jefferson Airplane song, which is so tears. I laughed so hard.
Oh, that bit with the rabbi is awesome.
Pays off. And then to leave you with that, and you're like, this is. I don't throw the word profound around a lot with movies. That's a profound movie.
It is. Absolutely is. So now we come to the top two. You know, this is going to be one where I have to say my choice for number two is one that I loved it when it first came out, and I actually had it at number three among their films until I recently revisited it, and it's one that really honestly flipped a coin. As Perry said, this is today's top ten. You know, maybe tomorrow I'll flip my one and two. But at number two, I have No Country for Old Men. You, Perry?
Oh, my number two was A Serious Man.
Oh, no, sorry. Yep. This is what happens when we flip things a little bit. So, Aaron.
Fargo. For everything
Fargo.
That's been mentioned. I think that what can I say about Fargo that hasn't been said? I'll just stop there. Fargo.
And, So, Perry, your number one Coen Brothers film.
It's Miller's Crossing. It's because that is an absolutely perfect script. There is not a word in that script that is not a screamingly funny and also absolutely necessary to the plot. A plot that, you know, I had to see the film three or four times before I could keep it all in my head. And when I realized how perfect it is, I was in awe and then got around to being in awe of every single shot, the design, performances that are out of this world by people who, for the most part, outside of Totoro and Buscemi, never showed up again in Coen world. And it's Gabriel Byrne is a thing of beauty in that movie. And I find it is a film that always eludes me. I cannot put into words how it makes me feel and what I think it is saying. It just is. It defies. It gets back to the Godardian, you know, the only way to criticize a film is to make a film. That's kind of true. I don't know how to put into some other medium my experience of watching Miller's Crossing every time I watch it. I just adore it.
Well, mine is, today, mine is Fargo for number one. And I think I know what yours is, Aaron.
Anyone who's talked to me about movies for more than about 10 minutes knows what mine is. No Country for Old Men is an absolute monolith of a film in my estimation. It was my number one American film of the decade it came out. If you count The Godfather and Godfather Part Two as one Best Picture winner, because really it is, this would rank second all time amongst Best Picture winners. I hate using this word. It's a perfect film. it absolutely is. There's not a single frame in this movie that I would take out or change. Roger Deakins, is probably the greatest cinematographer since Vin Nixvix. And this, for me, is, if it's not his masterpiece, it may as well be. I'll stop now because I'm gushing. But I could go on. I'll spare our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know... Yeah, and there you have it, folks. That is our top 10. Now, Joe, earlier we talked about some of the caveats. So what were some of these caveats that you had in mind for our questions or discussions?
Well, you know, at the beginning of each chapter of my critical study, The Holder in Human Comedy, I give a caveat, I guess that's the word, I call them the complaint, by you know, certain detractors of the Coen brothers, and then I try to deal with it, and it gives me a chance to I deal with the films thematically. I don't do chronological order, but you know, I write, for example, the complaint: the Coens are merely nihilists and juvenile mockers without a belief system, and I say they don't seem particularly religious, and they're clearly not doctrinaire. Ed Tom Bell admits in No Country for Old Men, I always figured when I got older, God would sort of come into my life somehow, and he didn't, and I don't blame him. If I were him, I'd have the same opinion of me that he does. But there's this dimension of spiritual exploration in their work that usually escapes notice, other than in The Serious Man, where it is overtly the theme. And in all of their films, and it's like Flannery O'Connor, she's not proselytizing for the Catholic faith, which she believes in because she didn't think that was the function of an artist, but she deals with people who are trying to understand what's, you know, all religions deal with the afterlife, and even people who are atheists have to think about, is there life after death, and they often think there isn't. And the Coens grapple with that, and Ballad of Buster Scruggs, there is a section that is the afterlife. It's very stylized. The end of the film, the last section, the characters are in a stagecoach, very abstract settings in the through the windows, and then they arrive at this soundstage hotel with a lot of fog, and it's clearly a representation of the afterlife, whatever that might be, but they're very enigmatic about it. But the characters are all kind of searching for some deeper meaning, and it's often very poignant in their films, such as Alice, the young woman in Buster Scruggs, who gets killed kind of in an absurd, terrible way. She kills herself, even though she shouldn't. She panics, and but she's wondering, and she talks about the Bible with the man she's falling in love with, and they're talking about their future. And the, actually, you know, one way to deal with this is to read this wonderful dialogue they wrote. They write such great dialogue that you can only do justice to it by quoting it. The man, Billy Heck, says, well, she says, she talks about her late brother. She says, I never had his certainties. I suppose it is a defect. He says, I don't think it's a defect at all. Oh, no, uncertainty. That is appropriate for matters of this world. Only regarding the next, we vouchsafe certainty. She says, yes. He says, I believe certainty regarding that which we can see and touch. That is seldom justified, if ever. And down the ages from our remote past, what certainties survive? The camera slowly moves in on her face, and then he says, and yet we hurry to fashion new ones, wanting their comfort, certainty. He laughs, that is the easy path, just as you said. And then she quotes the Bible. She says, straight is the gate. And then he quotes, and narrow the way, indeed, indeed. And the whole verse reads, because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way, which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. So these people, you know, are kind of, like most human beings, kind of desperately trying to figure out what happens to us after we die. And she dies in the next scene. The film takes us inexorably toward her death in this absurdist fashion. And it's tragic, but she's like an O'Connor character. She's trying to see over into the next world, but she can't. And that's the way all of us are. I mean, even atheists... I mean, you know, I mean, it's. I consider myself an agnostic because who knows? How do we know what lies beyond? And you know, I think we're kind of presumptuous to think we know anything. But I certainly am not religious like I used to be a long time ago. And they make it clear in Serious Man that they're not doctrinaire religious in any way. But they do deal with that issue, and the meaning of life is the way No Country for Old Men has a great ending where the sheriff tells his wife about a dream he had about his dead father, who was a lawman like him, and he was leading him on, and they were riding off together, and it's sort of inconclusive, like life is, and it just ends in this man's desolate face. He's trying to tell about his father went on before him, and he's going to go on soon. It's all about mortality, but he can't make sense out of the world, you know. And it makes me think of a great line in one of my favorite movies, Tell Them Willy Boy is Here, Abraham Polonsky's film. It's a great Western, radical
Western.
What a forgotten
talent Polonsky is.
Yeah, a forgotten talent, a great man, a great director. He was blacklisted. He made directed three films. He's a wonderful filmmaker. But one of the, it's about the kind of archetypal Indian chase. It's the kind of film I bet the Coens like. It's an absurdist Western, and Robert Redford pursuing Robert Blake, who's an Indian, but Blake is actually kind of pursuing the sheriff. But anyway, at one point, a character says to Redford's deputy sheriff, he said, it don't make sense, do it, and Redford says, maybe that's the sense it makes. I think that's kind of like in the Coen tradition that it don't make sense, but maybe that's the sense it makes. Our world is kind of insane and surreal. Look at the newspaper every day and, you know, all the crazy stuff that goes on and how do you make sense of it? That's what their characters are trying to figure out. That's why they seem like very significant filmmakers for today's world. And if people don't realize it now, they will later when they look back in this period and they think, well, these guys really captured the zeitgeist, you know. And sometimes we have to look back in retrospect to think that Capra captured the 1930s and Sturgis maybe the 40s and Cirque and Wilder the 50s. And, you know, the Coens seem to, in my view, capture the complexity and insanity of the world, and they try to grapple with it. They don't just sort of shrug their shoulders and laugh about it like their detractors think they do. That's why I wrote the book. I wanted to show that they're really serious artists, but when you make people laugh, sometimes they don't think you're serious, so that's a very short-sighted attitude.
So before we go, and Joe, you kind of got your last bit in there. So Perry, is there anything that we haven't mentioned yet that you would like to mention before we get going?
I'm just going to mention this in my own way. If I were to, you know, take the individual episodes of Buster Scruggs as their own film, yes, that the Zoe Kazan piece would have been probably in the top six.
Oh, it's a beautifully
masterful
piece.
Yeah, what a great piece of filmmaking. It's like John Ford is like Wagon Master, but from a kind of a sort of postmodern, but it's a very classical style, but the sentiments are very modern or postmodern, aren't they?
Well, you know, the thing is, it has one of their six or seven best movies. If it was expanded or taken on its own, the girl got shook episode. But you know, there are a lot of funny moments in Coen Brother movies. But a top 10 funny moment for me is when James Franco's character turns to the guy next to him on the gavels and says,
First time, huh? Yeah, and actually I'll mention another film that really fits in with the Barton Fink, Llewyn Davis trilogy is that harrowing episode in Buster Scruggs of the British thespian who is armless and legless, and he's hauled around by Liam Neeson, who's this very coarse impresario, and this guy has a beautiful voice, and he recites Shakespeare and the Bible and other verses, Abraham Lincoln, and to waning frontier audiences who don't quite get it. And then he dumps him in the river because he's not making money for him anymore. He trades him in for a chicken. And that's a really acid comment about the role of the artist in our culture. And, you know, if you don't make money, they throw you in the river, don't they?
And, you know, here's a bit of trivia. The actor who played that the attraction in the show, Harry Melling, he is, he of course is best known for the Harry Potter films where he played the cousin Dursley, Dudley Dursley, but he is also the grandson of the great Patrick Troughton.
Oh, yeah. And he's also in the Tragedy of Macbeth, Joel's film, too. Fine actor. Brilliant, brilliant actor. And that's such, I mean, talk about a harrowing piece of filmmaking. But, you know, that it is balanced by the laughable episodes. But they all kind of have, Zoe Kazan said there was a kind of poetic undercurrent, you know, to all the things that kind of ties them together. And the opening is very wonderfully absurd, where it's a parody of, they all kind of parody different kinds of Western films. It's my favorite genre, but in the first one, they parody the singing cowboy films, and but also the quick draw films, and then the guy goes to heaven, and you know, it's kind of in a weird way, it's a comic version of what happens at the end of the film when they all go to the afterlife, you know, and it's ridiculous, but it's part of the mystery of human nature, what happens to us after we're gone, after our brief time on Earth here, you know.
And finally to you, Aaron, anything that you want to say before we go, or is this pretty much it?
So, Burn After Reading's taking its hits from both sides, so I just want to throw in my two cents on Burn After Reading. It's the single greatest satire about the second Bush administration ever made. A band of idiots fumbling around with intelligence they don't understand because they're too dumb to understand it. Trying to sell out.
Now that makes me want to revisit it sooner than later.
Oh, it's a great political satire, and John Malkovich is so great. And the way it ends too, with the CIA director kind of covering the whole thing up, is hilarious. Yeah.
I think that part of what I didn't like about it was there's just something about, you know, and I love Brad Pitt as an actor. I think he's actually a very gifted performer, but there's just something about that performance that put me off. It wasn't that I thought it was a bad performance. There's just something that rubs me on a deep level in a wrong way. But like I said, you know, sometimes we can explain things. Usually we can, and sometimes we just can't. And this is one of those ones where, and partially because I haven't seen it a second time, I've just never been able to say more than, yeah, he just irked me in that film.
He's chewing gum a lot, but he's actually kind
of
sweet.
That may be part of it too. I will admit that's actually part of that is something that bothers me. I'm a teacher, and I hate when kids just start chewing gum. Oh my god! But
idiot. But he's sort of a sweet, charming guy. He's also very good in the Tarantino film, which I think is very flawed. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he's tremendous in that film. You know. So he could be used very well by directors who know how to make use of his talents, and he has considerable talents. And that's one reason, I think Burn After Reading, that's why it was actually very successful, because of him. The Brad Pitt audience went to see it, and that's what star quality can do for unusual filmmakers. You know, like with Billy Wilder would cast lovable stars like Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine, who would, as often was noted, made his bitter pills go down more easily because they were lovable actors that the public wanted to see, you know?
And give the audience credit for catching on to the zeitgeist. As well said, it's a great parody spoof of the second Bush administration that comes out right in 2008.
They went for it. And, you know, I mean, there's a great line from George Bernard Shaw who said, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you. And, you know, the movies that are the serious, heavy movies about the war in Afghanistan or Iraq failed at the box office usually. But if you can do it in a comedic way, it kind of works in a strange way. And that's one of the great things about satire. Satire is a much more serious business than people give it credit for being. And I think that's what the Coen brothers understand, and maybe the audience is ahead of the critics, as usual. You know, I don't think the critics today are the best understanders of what filmmakers should do, but the audience understands when a film works and when it doesn't work.
Well, with that, I think that, you know, we've basically covered everything. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank each of you for participating. And, you know, once again, don't forget, we'll be back in 2 weeks with an episode on Band of Brothers. Now, Perry, I forget, real quick, didn't you say you were interested in that, or was I imagining it?
No, I have to pass on Band of Brothers.
Okay, but you're in for Coppola, right?
Oh, wouldn't miss that for the world.
Okay, yep. Don't forget that's the 17th. Don't forget that's the 17th. Okay, okay. With that little bit of final housekeeping, on air housekeeping, no less. I once again want to thank everyone, and we will, and I do want to say this: if you have not picked up Joe's book on the Coen brothers or his others, do yourselves favors and do it. I mean, even, you know, if you can't afford them, go to the library, read them, write the man a letter of appreciation, you know, pick up a copy, ebook or whatever. They're all worth reading. So support the good history where you can find it, folks. So with that, I want to take us out on three. One.
Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. One, two, three. Good night, folks.
Good night.
Good night. Good night, guys. Thanks. It was a great discussion. You guys were terrific. All three.